Hi, this is Jim.
And this is Max.
Check out our podcast, The Step Over, Liberty Ballers Podcast Network, for all of your Sixers needs.
Player analysis, game breakdowns, who would look coolest in a headband, and more.
Subscribe to Liberty Ballers Podcast feed on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and check out The Step Over, a podcast about Sixers basketball.
Mostly.
It's out of here! Home run, Lenny Dykstra!
Stairs rips one into the night, deep into right, way out of here.
The Phillies win the game on a base hit by Mitch Williams at 4:40 in the morning.
Swing and a miss, struck him out. It's wacky, wonderful. Bunch of throwbacks has won the National League pennant.
Welcome back to Continued Success, a podcast the success of which is continuing, though the Phillies' own success may not be. Hello, I am Justin Clue, the assistant editor of The Good Fight, and with me on this podcast, as always, is Liz Rocher, the managing editor of The Good Fight. Hello, Liz.
King of the intros, Justin Clue, everyone.
I remembered our names and our jobs.
I'm not criticizing. I've done the intro a grand total of once. I think I swallowed my tongue.
Which you nailed it.
Because I'm just talking normal now.
It's all anyone was talking about for the next week was Liz's intro last time. So I understand why you would bring it up immediately upon the start of the next episode. But this is, of course, the Phillies podcast. It's different from Hittin' Season, the other podcast Liz and I show up on Sunday nights with John Stolness. Because this one is happening now in the middle of the week. But the other difference between this and Hittin' Season is that we don't just talk about what's going on with the current Phillies. We also look back at the 2008 and 1993 Phillies seasons and talk about what they were up to around this time. Of course, you probably know that, but we also have not done that on this podcast a couple of times, just because there's been so much to welcome, you know, you could say complain about, but also just discuss as far as the Phillies go this year. I feel like, Liz, and I do want to mention that today we are going to make a point to get back to the historical roots of this podcast's basic concept. But before we do that, let's not do it. And Liz, would you feel like it's accurate to say this Phillies season has brought about, it's generated just through the players and the team's record and the managerial decisions, some of far more debatable points than the past couple of Phillies seasons? Feels like it's been a lot of limp dead seasons the past couple of years. This one, I think at least there's more lively rhetoric about the Phillies, about what they should do, what things are destroyed, who sucks, who does not suck, things of that nature. Would you say at least that is a point that is correct?
Well, it's a direct result of things happening. Like players from the minors being brought to the majors, like as opposed to the last couple of seasons where it was just a never ending parade of crap for the most part, you know, like nothing happened that was worth talking about. There were no expectations. And so the result of like everyone simultaneously giving a shit a little bit more has resulted in, you know, a better team, a more interesting team, and, you know, lots and lots of debate about all the things the team is doing.
Yeah, I mean, this is a point that I brought up on Hittin' Season, and I guess I'm bringing it up now just to expand on it a little bit, if there's anything to expand on it from. And that was that there seems to be now a much more, Gabe Kapler has become a much more polarizing figure, in that there's people who will never be happy with anything he does, and people who've decided that he will.
He is the way, the truth, wrong. And the light.
That is a smaller camp, but one that certainly exists if you operate in the circles we operate in. And that's fine. That's fine if you want to think that.
There you go.
But it's starting to seem like there's just two encampments now. And of course, the answer is to live somewhere in between and react when something to your fancy occurs, and react again when something not to your fancy occurs. And in either case, you know, you're judging it by how you think the team should be operating. But in this case, it just seems like there's a lot more zealots who believe that Gabe Kapler will never make a wrong decision, and there's people who believe he's never made a right one. And I guess that's inevitable when you have such a figure, a polarizing figure like Gabe Kapler. But at the same time, it's made the past couple of weeks pretty interesting.
And I don't really know if we're going to know which, you know, camp is right for quite a while. It'll be some time. I think the Phillies are pretty committed to their managerial decision, because I feel like he's pretty much just doing what everyone tells him to do. You know, he has the information and the data and he's making the decisions. And so
I agree. I mean, I think that goes with any baseball decision. And we all know that, that you don't really know how a trade's going to work out until both players involved have their entire careers. And that goes certainly for managers as well. So I think that's unavoidable. So it's tough. We all know that. And that's what makes it so strange that we all pretend like what's happening right in front of our face is the only thing that's going to happen. But I also get, you know, it's sports, it's emotional. We're all going to have gut responses to anything that happens out there, especially stuff we're unfamiliar with. But yeah, it's made for a real fun second half of the season, no doubt. Speaking of which, we're not going to harp on this too much. I feel like you and I have spent a lot of time talking about the Phillies and the playoffs and how they're not going. And we've sort of resigned to the fact that they're not going. And even if they were to somehow get in now, you wouldn't feel stupid for counting them out. I mean, we've all watched this team for the past 6 weeks. This has not been a team that looks like it could be or even wants to be in the playoffs. But it's cracking me up because it seems like the Phillies website seems to have just recently figured out that they could still make the playoffs, and like every headline is invoking the playoffs in some capacity. I remember people laughing at the Phillies for like sending out playoff ticket information in like 2012 when they were pretty much out of it, but I guess they were just so used to being like, you know, sending that email, they sent it out and people were like, oh boy. And in this case, yeah, look at some of these headlines. Eflin starts as playoff race heats up. Phil's rally to keep up playoff push in East wild card. Phil's come back to stay in playoff hunt. Pizza deals don't get any better than this. Well, that one's not. But you get the idea that Phillies slowed by Mets in postseason chase. Phil's missed sweep shot to trim NL East deficit. Like, okay, guys. Yes. You know, technically the math is there, but yeah, I mean, someone didn't tell the marketing department that this team was, in the playoff hunt until very recently, it sounds like.
Yeah. I mean, we're still mathematically in it, which is what's, you know, as long as there's a chance. And I'm done with it. Let me just enjoy the rest of the season in peace.
What are you excited for in baseball? Not even necessarily, and maybe let's just say outside of the Phillies, but you know, maybe something involving the Phillies. Let's make it a two-part question. What are you excited to see as the season winds down from the Phillies, if anything? And what are you excited to see from all of baseball as the season, you know, hits the playoff push? Because I know, like, September baseball can be more exciting in some capacities than October baseball. You know, seeing a team just make it into the playoffs is exciting, and then seeing that team get eliminated in, you know, three games in the NLDS is not as exciting. So I mean, yeah, what are you looking forward to, Phillies or otherwise, as the season winds down?
I'm looking forward to seeing another Aaron Nola start. I think he's got maybe two left. Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to seeing that. You know, I it's fun. I'm looking forward to the God, the NL West is real close between the Dodgers and Colorado. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and they're playing each other right now, I believe. So
yeah, in Milwaukee and St. Louis. And with Colorado a game and a half back in the wild card. My goodness, I'm excited to see that. I like that there's a race. There's no race anymore.
We have focused
in the AL. It's so boring.
Yeah, we have focused a lot on the NL East for obvious reasons, but that has not been that fun of a race. It really could have been a lot of fun. Like if the Phillies had stayed, if they had stayed closer to the median and not sunken so far below it, while the Braves kind of kept the way they were going and the Nationals like made that surge, that would have been a really interesting playoff picture. Maybe the most interesting in baseball, but that's just not what happened. And you're right that in the AL, it's the Red Sox, it's the Indians. And then the AL West is like, okay, Athletics are fun. That's a possibility. But yeah, for the most part, it's like, yeah, a lot of high numbers that make things a little less interesting. But in the NL, you know, outside of the NL East, there's some cool things happening. And I've become a follower of the Brewers. Every one of these teams has a little too large reason to find them utterly disdainful. Obviously, the whole Josh Hader thing was just so stupid this year. But Christian Yelich, oh my God.
Oh, he's so much fun, man. God, I love him.
What an acquisition. I mean, that is a perfect example of them working it out. I saw some Brewers fans online talking about how, looking at the lineup for whatever day it was, compared to, I guess, the beginning of the season. And they've, you know, Yelich is in there. Granderson is in there. Gio Gonzalez was starting. Jonathan Scope's out there now. He wasn't doing too well, but that was, I remember when that happened, I was like, that's a great addition for the Brewers. You know, he's one of those low key solid players the Orioles have had for a couple of years. So yeah, I was kind of hoping, if we get into a World Series favorites conversation, I'm picking the Brewers right now because they're a little bit under the radar. They're not so much of a favorite, and they're fun and, you know, interesting.
They're a small market team that has had to build. I mean, they've worked hard and really kind of played the odds on a lot of things, you know, taking some chances. But they really went hard this offseason with Lorenzo Cain. Lorenzo Cain, no one has talked about him. He's been great. He's got an on-base percentage near 400. You know, he's hitting 308. He's an outfield with Lorenzo Cain and Christian Yelich. And Ryan Braun is also there. he's second place on the team with home runs. Ryan Braun has hit. Hold on. Nope, that's not true. I was looking at the wrong row. He is not. So he's really not doing much for them, but he's not totally sucking. Like, he's also there. I really can't stand him. That's the only thing I don't want from this is for him to get anything at all from it, but he will. And I can accept that for the rest of it because, like, they have their rotation is just like how, like, they have an offense that's decent enough to overcome some rotation stuff. Oh God, Wade Miley I had no idea how well he was doing this year. I really like the Brewers.
Yeah. So there's plenty of things to look forward to. September baseball always.
I like the Brewers and I like one player on the Cubs. I like the Brewers. We all like Javi Baez.
We all like, this is obviously a low key Javi Baez fan podcast disguised as a Phillies podcast.
How is he so fun? Why did the Phillies miss out on players like this? Like, where did they all go?
That was going to be my next point, is that part of the reason you find yourself like leaning into some of these particular teams at a time like this in a season like this is that you're like, oh, because these are the players or the types of players I wanted on the team I follow and that I cover. But, you know, we don't have those players. So I'll just, I'll just pretend this is the team we all get to put on. This is the time of year we all get to put on another team's mask and pretend that we're different people rooting for different teams. But yeah, we still cover the Phillies on this podcast and that's all. That's fine. That's fine. Right now we're going to talk about the 1993 Phillies first and what some stuff related to their September times. That was 25 years ago. 25 years ago, Liz. Imagine if it was 25 years ago for you, what would you be doing right now? Would you be kicking?
I was 10. Nice. I was 10. I was coming home from school, or I was almost coming home from school.
Yeah. So
whatever
was I.
Grade it was I'd be, that I was.
I'd be coming home from kindergarten. The first day of kindergarten, we were told to bring fly swatters, and we didn't know why. And we used them, it turns out, to put them in like the stuff that makes bubbles. And when you would just wave the fly swatters around, they would make tons of bubbles. And I was like, this is, I think school is going to be pretty cool. Flash forward to me refusing to walk at my college graduation because I wanted to go see Star Trek, the motion picture.
Justin.
I haven't forgiven myself for that yet.
I really
robbed my parents of something special that day. That was
oh my God, that actually happened?
Moving along, 1993, magical year in Philadelphia. Ruben Amaro, that's a name you might be familiar with, Liz.
I'm going to bring this up forever. I'm sorry.
I don't see why. Ruben Amaro, he's quoted in the book we keep referencing on this podcast, More Than Beards, Bellies, and Biceps by Bob Gordon and Tom Burgoyne. He talked about how he had been promoted in 1992 in the month of September as a member of the expanding roster. And he said he was eating in a restaurant called Rockfish when Larry Anderson and Danny Jackson came in to talk to him about giving 100% because they were like they really felt like they were building someplace special. They're building something special in the Phillies clubhouse. They felt like they had a lot of the pieces they'd need to be a pretty solid, good baseball team. And these guys were all guys who they're famous for how well they got along. So I think a lot of that was going into it, too. Keep in mind, the 1992 Phillies had 70 wins. They finished in last place. So it takes a special frontline read on the situation to be like, hey, we're really building something special here.
We don't feel like you're giving enough.
It was the third
last place bad / mediocre team.
Not even you're not giving enough. It's you better give enough. he hadn't played for them yet. I don't believe Ruben Amaro had been in the minors. He was called up. Yeah. And so he gets this warning in what I'm sure he characterizes as much more of like putting him on notice, but not like a threat of any kind. But he goes on to, 1 year later, he certainly learned his lesson and he had two hits in 9 games in September for the 1993 Phillies. But that's cherry picking here. He was obviously a bench player for that team who, a role player. He didn't have the chance to make a ton of contributions, but he assimilated well with that locker room by his own approximation. He did talk about how that was a team, and obviously we've mentioned this a lot, 1993 Phillies and all. It was a team of 25 throwback players, and he I'm not sure exactly when this book that we're using as a reference came out. It was sometime later, at least one era later in Major League Baseball, because Ruben Amaro said, I think there might be like 40 types of throwback players in the entire league at this point, and this was a team of 25 of them. So that kind of brings up my question, Liz. What exactly is a throwback player? What do people mean when they say throwback player? And why are they a dying species?
I mean, people mean so many different things. Like, I'm in the middle of reading The Glory of Their Times right now. Have you read that?
Which grisly real-life murder story is that, Liz? Knowing your taste in books.
No, it's a baseball book. It is interviews. It was published in the 60s. Interviews with baseball players from the 1910s and teens. Told in their own words, like he traveled 75,000 miles around the country and found baseball players from this era, interviewed them, and a number of them got into the Hall of Fame after the book was published. And that's full of throwback players like Rube Marquard, who's I'm trying to remember if this is the guy whose father didn't want him to play baseball, and he literally stowed away on a train. Like, he rode the rails to get to his first professional baseball job.
That's sick as hell.
That is, it's, you would love this book. I'm going to finish reading it and I will send it your way.
Some of the projects I'm working on now, like that you just described, kind of like this guy's doing my dream job from another era.
it's one of the, I found it at a used bookstore in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And if I remember the name of the bookstore, I would tell all of you to visit it. I will tweet it out at some point because they have you walk down these stairs, just this enormous sports section full of sports books from all sports, and they have a huge baseball selection. I found that there. And I also found a book on the Federal League, the one-year Federal League, the first attempt for of baseball players to organize. Like, that's throwback.
Okay.
Like, guys hopping leagues. Like, what these guys, what, you know, Ruben Amaro means, and they mean it's, you know, guys who don't, you know, who take pleasure in not being like everybody else. Who, I mean, John Kruk was sort of like, I don't know why they call him a throwback. He just sort of feels like it from an era of baseball where guys were just effortlessly good and no one gave a shit.
I think,
is that what it is?
I mean, I think a lot of what you're saying is accurate. Definitely. I think when you describe it, like back to an era when going off to play baseball was akin to running away to joining the circus, that kind of thing. Like guys who would have played for free, I guess. But I think the 93 Phillies were a little too forward in the modern version of the game for that to be accurate. Like, obviously, I think they just really wanted to be there. I think you're talking about a bunch of guys who's like, not to get too cliche, but like their uniforms were always dirty. I mean, think about Gabe Kapler and his body type versus John Kruk's body type. And like, that's also a throwback player. Guys who could just as easily be on your dad's softball team. As you know, but they're on a major league baseball roster. I think a lot of guys who would probably complain about PC culture are throwback players.
I sort of think of it as, you know, the, like, John Kruk reminds me of the type of guy that, you know, they talked about in Ken Burns Baseball, like the hard drinking, hard living, out of shape baseball player from like the early to mid 20s or something like that, from that period where fire engines were still a thing that people ran after because they were so new.
I saw,
you know, that's it. Like, that's why John Kruk evokes that, because he's a fat baseball player.
But that's not the only thing that a throwback player is. I think it's a combination.
Oh, no, I know. But I just, like, that's been sticking.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Head. I'm just saying that's not our conclusion here. I think it's a combination of all those things. Because when you say throwback, you're talking about a guy who seems like he's from a past era of baseball. And I think that's what people mean when they're talking about the 1993 Phillies, that this was a team of guys who seemed like they could have just been from the local bar. And they were like Philadelphia's local nine. You know, other teams would come through and they'd be like, well, where's your team? Who are your guys? And they'd be like, oh, those guys over there. Those guys who are like having a putting challenge between games of a doubleheader and are certainly drunk. Those are our guys. And then they would win. And that was the difference.
Yes.
But I saw not long after I was just looking into this and how people were defining throwback players. Eno Saris of The Athletic actually tweeted about using the word throwback to describe Kyle Freeland, the pitcher on the Rockies, who's having a great season and is a big part of their success this year. And the way he characterized it, he called him a throwback ace, and he characterized it because he throws a lot of different pitches. And not necessarily like the same pitch in every situation. He says, quote, dotting the corners and throwing any pitch on any count. And I think like that's accurate in the same way, because what he's saying is it seems like this guy doesn't use computers, analytics, numbers to necessarily be effective. I think it was more like, I want to throw this pitch because any one of my pitches can get you out. And like back in the day, you know, if we're throwing back to a past era, that's probably closer to what the philosophy was. I'm not saying that's necessarily what Freeland is thinking, but when you like break down that description, I think that's kind of what he's getting at by throwback ace. Like, he's not throwing, oh, I'm in, you know, the count's this, there's runners here, and I know this guy does this, so I'm going to throw him this pitch, or I'm not going to throw him that pitch because that's what he's expecting because I did it last time. I think it's just him being like, what pitch do I feel like throwing? What pitch do I think this guy can't hit?
I would agree with that. You know, it could mean anything to anybody. It's all things to all people.
Everyone describe throwback however you want. That's our conclusion here. But our definition is the right one, just so everyone knows. So this throwback team of Phillies in 1993 Today, we're going to talk about what they were getting up to in September, and we're going to focus in on the infamous series in Montreal that is one of the more hallmark moments of the season because they were kind of in the middle of possibly losing too much to be the 1993 team we remember. They were sort of being exactly the kind of team Phillies fans were used to seeing. And they went to Montreal, the team that had been annoying them all season long. The Cardinals had been an annoyance for the Phillies and had beaten them a couple of bad losses. But eventually the Cardinals wound up trading their closer, Lee Smith, to the Yankees. And that was sort of seen as them waving the white flag, and they were done for the year. The Cardinals would finish 10 games out of first place. The Expos would finish the season 3 games out of first place. And by the time the Phillies were going to Montreal for this, I believe it was the last time they played the Expos that season, it was obviously a big deal. They were playing, you know, we keep talking about the Phillies. They play the Braves 7 more times this year, which is kind of incredible. Given how much baseball.
God.
But we're talking about the Phillies. You know, they had a pretty sizable margin for a while. They were up 11 games in the NL East at this point. They were 80-47 on August 25th. By the time they headed to Montreal on September 17th, that lead was down to 5.5 games. And then when they lost to Montreal in the first game, 8-7, they were only up 4 games. So their lead had shrunk from 10-4. That is alarming, and it is indicative of a swoon that is, you know, I hesitate to bring it up, but they were already referencing it. 1964, the collapse that occurred back then to that team in September. You know, obviously the Expos fans were aware of that, and they were ready to use it to scream at the Phillies. So I actually, in doing research for this, I found an article called, the series that almost killed the 93 Phillies. And I was like, oh, this will be interesting. Turns out I wrote it 4 years ago. And so I'm using a couple of references from that just because I remembered why I wrote it.
From my own writing.
This is super obnoxious. Yes, I agree. First of all.
No. It's not obnoxious. It's just you've already written the exact article it is that you need for this.
This is perfect. God, thanks, past self, for sending this into the future for me. First of all, I have to mention that I started this off but with a tweet of a woman who has a picture of Jim Fregosi's daughter and Darren Dalton's son, who were like very young children at the time. They're very young children wearing their father's jerseys and like basically wearing full baseball uniforms. So she's wearing a little Fregosi jersey and he's wearing a Dalton jersey. And they're like walking. She has her arm around his shoulders and he looks like he's grabbing her ass. And it's it's like, yeah, yep, that's Darren Dalton's son. Yeah.
that's no.
Perfect.
No.
So basically, Montreal was ready to blow up at this point. If you see footage from this series in any like the old yearbooks and anything, the Olympic Stadium was exploding. They wanted to beat the Phillies so badly. The Montreal Gazette ran a headline that said, Expos Phillies series isn't baseball, it's war. Expos were perfectly happy to turn this into an unpleasant experience for the Phillies. Frank Fitzpatrick wrote in the Inquirer, one fan dangled a large yellow noose over the Phillies dugout and waved it frantically whenever someone in gray and red neared before the game. Hey, Phillies, he screamed. 1964. It's 1964 again. That was...
my God! What?
Yeah. Brutal. So, yeah, he goes on. This is not one of Jim Fregosi's favorite subjects, but the manager laughed off the taunt when it was directed at him. A hobbling Pete Incaviglia, however, had some angry and unusual suggestions for the young man and his rope.
Oh, my God.
Again, throwback. I think I'm getting it. Interacting with the fans, generally frowned upon in modern baseball. Interacting with them in a negative way, I guess. Pete Incaviglia, probably... Yeah, top of the power rankings. When I describe this team as they look like guys from your dad's softball team, probably the top of the list is Pete Incaviglia, then John Kruk.
Yes.
Most assuredly. The Expos, a pitcher for the Expos, John Wetteland, he actually said in the two reporters, quote, "Philly will fold," he told Montreal Gazette's Jeff Blair. "They'll hit the skids at some point, the same as everyone else does." So they were not even, they were like just kind of, it was a foregone conclusion the Phillies were going to blow this. And, you know, hey, can you blame them given the Phillies' history? John Kruk, then the series actually started and the Phillies lost 2 of 3 to the Expos. And that was, you know, they kind of limped out of Canada just being like, oh my God, I can't believe, like, it's so good that we won that one game. Because if they had gotten swept, it would have been an utter disaster. And, like, who knows? I can't say, the Expos had to have some momentum, like winning the series, but sweeping the Phillies would have been a different kind of momentum. And John Kruk kind of describes the, there's a moment he has here that in his own memoirs called I Ain't an Athlete Lady. And he talks about that series close to the end of the book. And he says, there was a moment where Mitch Williams threw the ball over to first base to try and pick off Larry Walker. And the ball, it was a terrible throw and it like went past him. And obviously the place went crazy. And in having to retrieve the ball, John Kruk had to like run closer to the stands where everyone was screaming. So he says, then he threw the ball away, trying to pick him off. What was even worse, when I went over to pick up the ball, I stepped on it and just about blew out my knee and back. And it was scary because Walker was getting into scoring position. And it was embarrassing. I'm not sure what the crowd was saying then, but I think it was French for, here's this big fat ass rolling around on the field for no reason. I wonder how you say that in French. Like, that's honestly, that's a lot. That's a mouthful. I don't think you can fit that on a banner.
No, you can't say that John Kruk doesn't have a sense of humor about
himself. It's one of his favorite topics.
Like, self-deprecating sense of humor is something that I not only employ myself but relate to very well. You know, very much. So I appreciate that about him.
Of course. Yeah. No, that's one of his most endearing qualities. But yeah, the Expos won this series. There was in one game, the Expos player Curtis Pride actually had a 2-run double that tied the game. He was apparently almost completely deaf. Did you know? Have you ever heard of him? Me neither. Yeah. It kind of reminded me of a Abbott, not Kyle Abbott. Jim Abbott.
He was on the Yahoo Sports MLB podcast last week talking about his home hitter.
I'm always utterly amazed by Jim Abbott and his entire career. It was one of those things that you read about as a kid and you're like, that's amazing. And then you grow up and you're like, well, people aren't really talking about this as much. I guess it wasn't as amazing. But in his case, it actually has remained. I am as awestruck of Jim Abbott as I was when I was a kid. A one-handed pitcher in... We all freaked out when Pat Venditti came up and he could throw with both hands. This guy had one hand and he threw a no-hitter. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned this when someone tweeted about the anniversary of the no-hitter. I was like, I can't believe this isn't something we talk about every day in baseball, because it is utterly amazing to me that incredible. Happened. And being almost...
It's like, well...
Go ahead.
It's like Shaquem Griffin. Is he on the Seahawks? Shaquem Griffin has one hand. He's in the NFL with one hand.
It's like the things you have to do to be a professional athlete and then have the added... obstacles that come with only having one hand. I mean, that's unbelievable. Like, what a testament to, you know, the human being's ability to overcome adversity and all that. But like, still, I mean, being almost completely deaf is also a huge challenge. And he became like an effective player and contributor for the Expos, and clearly, you know, was the reason they won one of these big games that they thought could propel them into the playoffs. And yeah, it's crazy. The Mets had told him the year before that he, in his words, that he had no future. The Mets, of course, felt betrayed because Pride had demanded to start the year at AAA and they like weren't ready to put him at that level. I don't know. It was just, I'm mentioning this because look, Liz, even back then,
the Mets sucked.
Just kind of a real public mess still to this mm-hmm. day.
I do have to mention, you mentioned a deaf baseball player in the glory of their times. Several of the players I've read about so far talked about a deaf and a mute player. No one knew his first name, or at least no one in the book knew his first name. his nickname was Dummy. Nice. They called him Dummy Hoy.
That's terrific.
Yeah, he had no problem. He would make a noise when he was going to catch a ball. Like, it's fascinating. I just want to read a book on that guy, who I think died right before the dude started traveling around to get, you know, stories for the book.
Yeah, that guy has, I think he's got 40,000 words or so of a story to write. I think that's perfectly reasonable.
But he wasn't even the only one. There was another one in the majors, too. And I don't remember his last name, but his nickname was also, you guessed it, Dummy.
A lot of dummies running around back then. Pretty brutal with the nicknames back then, it feels like.
But they made it into baseball. Yeah, yeah. Like, granted, it was a little different then than it was now, but like, he made it into baseball. That's not nothing.
It is. That's wild. And I appreciate the brutality of nicknames from that bygone era. You never really had to, a lot of times you didn't really have to wonder why a guy had his nickname. You're just like, oh, that's the way that they would say that back then. That's a shame. But hey, you know, he made it in baseball, so it didn't really blow him up too much.
Country boys were literally nicknamed Rube. That is not a joke.
Well, speaking of getting blown up, I'll just do a quick run through of this series. The first game, Ben Rivera got blown up. We've talked about Ben Rivera on this podcast before and his penchant for giving up walks. He had five of them in less than five innings in a, you know, big game. Phillies emptied their bullpen. Roger Mason, Bobby Thigpen, Larry Anderson, David West, Don Paul, Mitch Williams all showed up. Larry Anderson blew the game, or he got the blown save. The Phillies chased Dennis Martinez from the game. He only lasted 5 1/3. El Presidente, he gave up seven hits, four runs and three earned, and the game went into extra innings. So it was the Phillies scored seven runs in the sixth inning and did not win this game. They were down 3-0. Wow. And then had this explosion of offense that they were, you know, perfectly capable of all season long. Darren Dalton homered off Dennis Martinez. He had a three-run shot, and then Jim Eisenreich doubled, and then Dennis Martinez left the game. Milt Thompson reached on an error. Kevin Stocker walked. Then Mickey Morandini walked and a run got walked in. Lenny Dykstra hit a sac fly. Mariano Duncan hit a double. And there was like at least one throwing error on the play that allowed more runs to score. Like it was brutal inning. Phillies went up 7-3 and things were looking good. But then the Expos just chipped away. And Curtis Pride hit that double in the bottom of the seventh to tie the game. And then Marquise Grissom, Curtis Pride hit a double that put them within one, and then Marquise Grissom tied the game off Larry Anderson. And then in the bottom of the 12th, Mitch Williams gave up a sac fly that lost the Phillies the game. So that was perfectly painful. And then the Phillies came back and won the second game by one. So all three of these games were determined by one run, by the way. That's how this, you talk about like missing or not missing the Phillies being part of a playoff run. Can you imagine watching a series like this that is determined by 3 1-run games, one of which goes into the 12th inning?
I feel like we've,
I mean,
done
we've certainly done it. It's just like,
but it's so painful. Like I remember the feeling, like the ultimate frustration, because like, you know, they know how to score runs. The pitching is doing exactly what it's supposed to do. So close.
They kind of gave us a hint of a taste of that. And like, that was enough for everyone in 2018 to lose their fucking minds. And, we all freaked out, turned on each other. And, you know, among the bodies, as the dust settled and the smoke cleared, we realized the Phillies were actually not even going to the playoffs most likely. So yeah.
Compare that to a
key series with the team nipping at the Phillies' heels, in that team stadium, determined by 3 1-run games. I mean, in the second game, Tommy Green hit a late RBI single in the sixth inning to make it 4-1. The Phillies actually went up 5-1. And in the bottom of the eighth, Will Cordero of the Expos hit a 3-run home run that made it 5-4. That late in the game, and it was just like, oh my god, I can't believe they didn't lose this game. This is probably the biggest, I'm not even gonna say the biggest win of the Phillies regular season that year. I would say it's the biggest not loss of the Phillies regular season, because there was that 3-run home run in the eighth. They go into the, they do nothing in the top of the ninth. Lenny Dykstra had a leadoff walk, but then he got caught stealing. So it was essentially a 1-2-3 inning. The bottom of the ninth comes around. Obviously, the Expos are like, we're going to win this game. And people in Philadelphia were probably like, they're going to definitely win this game. Mitch Williams allows a one-out walk to Larry Walker. But they picked him. I'm trying to figure this out specifically here. Walker was picked off first base, but he was safe because, oh, this must have been the throwing error that John Kruk was talking about. So <Yeah. laughs> look at that detective work. So that happened. Walker went to second base, then he stole third base. So they had a runner on third. But I guess there were two outs at that point, and Mitch Williams managed to get the third out. But, like, no, they had a runner on third with one out. Mike Lansing struck out, and Sean Berry flew out. So they were 90 feet away from losing or at least tying that game. And, the Phillies actually managed to come away with a win. And then in the last game, the Expos again scored late in the game to win. Like, all three of these games, they came through in the eighth or ninth inning. The Phillies had built a lead of five, or they had scored in the third and fifth inning, and it was 5-4. And then nobody scored from the sixth to the eighth, and in the bottom of the ninth, the Expos won the game off. I assume Mitch Williams again. Yep. Mitch Williams, hell of a series, hell of a preview. He gave up a single, and again, there was, a throwing error of some kind, and Will Cordero walked it off, and the Expos won. And that was just brutal. That was a brutal September series for the Phillies that they somehow walked away from, but that's what they were up to at this time. They left Montreal up 4.5 games in the NL East with 13 left to play. So, I don't know, not ideal. Riz, how did you feel when people kept comparing when the Phillies this year were – 7 back with 17 to play, just like they were in 2007. What was your take on that little comparison?
Stop it right now. What are you doing? It's easy and lazy. Why are you doing this? Like, yes, we all know. We're not stupid. We can see. We've got eyes. Most of us were alive, forming memories back
I'm
then.
Pretty stupid.
Like, don't do that. Don't just. They're in no way the same. They're not in any way the same. So please.
Would you say it's at least worth mentioning? Is it that?
There's a difference. Yes, there's a difference between mentioning it and being like, look at these two things. Directly compare them, guys.
Somebody said that fact, and then I just saw the Jim Carrey from Dumb and Dumber gif appear in my brain because I knew that's all people were going to. We're going to respond with, like, so you're saying there's a chance? Like, okay, guys, look, I don't want to land on one side or the other. All I'm saying is, have you watched this team in the past couple of weeks? This team is not a playoff team.
Like, just
certainly
just putting it out there, like, look at these two things. Like, no, shut up. No.
Well, let's zip ahead to 2008, a year when there were no Expos anymore. Right. Yeah. No, there were no Expos anymore. And the 2008 Phillies were having their own September fun. In this case, they went on a tear in the middle of September. They won 7 games in a row. They swept the Brewers in 4 games at home and then went to Atlanta and swept the Braves as well.
God, remember that? Could do that?
Yeah. Yeah. Then they actually won 6 of their last 9 games too. They finished the season sweeping Washington. And they had already clinched.
They just
so that's
rode the
awesome.
Hot hand right into the playoffs. That is a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Timed that real nicely. They were 17-8 in the month of September.
Ooh.
So they cruised.
Damn.
Yeah. Really made up for their 12-14 June, which sucked. But yeah, they were still competing at that point. They swept the Brewers in 4 games. Earlier that month, they had gotten an email from none other than Mike Schmidt. Liz, Mike Schmidt sends emails.
No, he doesn't.
It seems. I too was surprised. Like, I'm not saying, hey, I'm sure I would have guessed Mike Schmidt was capable of sending an email, but I don't know. The Mike Schmidt we've gotten to know via broadcast the past couple of years seems like he might be like, oh, I'm not interested in that.
I mean, my assumption is that one of his children or perhaps his wife did it for him.
It's all certainly plausible that he dictated. But he sent them a 71-word email with a bunch of very inspirational talk in it. The one thing, the quote from it I was going to read to you was, the Mets know you're better than they are. They remember last year. So what do you think? Like, is that obviously I'm of the mind, like, when you think about what has inspired you at your job in the past, it seems like anything can, like, any passing thought you can just, like, be triggered into being like, you know what, fuck it, I'm gonna do this, like, by anything, a conversation, a movie scene, a song that gets you jazzed. But, like, obviously an email from Mike Schmidt is at least intended to resonate with a Phillies team specifically. But I guess I'm more focusing on, like, how mentally destroyed do you think the Mets actually were by that? Like, there were times when it was like, yeah, it's the business of baseball. It's how baseball works. It's a loss. Eventually you get over it. But you also know that players do get, you know, traumatized by particular losses. And the Mets in 07 and 08 were eliminated from the postseason on the last day of the regular season two consecutive years. What are the odds of that? That's just absurd. And that has to have left them, like, burned mentally, the guys who were there for both seasons, at least. Like, it must have, right?
I mean, I can only assume. I mean, it's, if they'd had more chances they'd missed, I think maybe those guys would be haunted by it. Like, you look at a guy like David Wright, and he's got bigger ghosts to deal with. But, you know, I don't know if guys from that period are really completely burned by it. I want them to be. I would like it if those Phillies teams haunted the dreams of someone. Like, I wonder if, you know, the 2008 Phillies haunt, you know, Carl Crawford's dreams or something.
Oh, what happened? Where's Carl Crawford?
Retired, probably.
There you go.
I mean, he was part of that blockbuster Red Sox-Dodgers trade a few years ago. Mm-hmm. I think that must have been 2012. And I think he bounced, maybe it was just them, or I thought he bounced around a little bit. But yeah, he just sort of faded right out after being, you know, he was just an incredibly promising player that I don't think ever really fully delivered on. Yeah. Here's another fun 2008 name, Rocco Baldelli. Remember that guy?
Oh, hell yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. He hit the home run that kept things interesting.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's, we should talk about the Rays.
We definitely should. That's a team I ended up having a lot of affection for, if only because the Phillies beat them. I mean, I like, if the Phillies had lost, I'd hate them. But because they won, I gave myself permission to not think they're terrible.
Right, you just want to tussle their hair and be like, ah, that was a nice try.
Yeah.
Well, Mike Schmidt sent that email right before they played the Mets on September 7th. They had just lost a series to the Nationals, and people were kicking themselves a little bit. Before that, they split a series, a four-game series in Chicago against the Cubs. And the Mets, you know, they had a three-game series against the Mets. That was the end of this road trip they were on. And yeah, right before that, you know, imagine that being like a moment of sadness, like that. They're like, oh man, we just split a series and then lost a series. We're really down in the doldrums here compared to, like, the amount of series in a row that this team lost this year. Like, boy, what kind of sad ass, hell ass doldrums is this team in? Good God.
Seriously.
In any case, Mike Schmidt sends them that email, and they win 2 out of 3 from the Mets. The one game they play a doubleheader. There's a moment in Phillies Confidential, the untold inside story of the 2008 championship season by Gary Matthews and Scott Lauber, where Chris Coast kind of mentions that even, like, he had doubts at certain points during the season, like, in the Phillies, if that's, like, something that you would ever. He said backup catcher Chris Coast admitted that he began to doubt that the Phillies would make the playoffs. And it wasn't until they beat Ben Sheets, who was, like, you know, a premier pitcher at that time, on September 11th against that in the first game of that four game series against the Brewers, that he was, like, returned to being really confident in the team. But I don't know. Chris Coast, I remember being pretty forthcoming with his feelings. I remember him out of, like, a press or in an interview saying, like, oh yeah, Carlos Ruiz and I talk about it all the time, and we want to be the catchers who are, like, here together forever. I was just like, aww. Oh, okay, that's just something you just say. All right. But in this case, yeah, it's like, well, I guess, I mean, how much like players believing that their team is going to the playoffs. I guess I wasn't really going to bring this up, but I'm just kind of curious. So last night after the Phillies beat the Mets and Greg Murphy was interviewing Jorge Alfaro on the team, and they kind of, or it might've been Jim Murphy on the radio. And they were just talking about like, oh, this team and what you guys are, you know, mentioning the playoffs, you guys are still in the playoffs, and kind of giving him the prompt to talk about how like, oh, this team never gives up, blah, blah, blah. I don't know. I mean, knowing that Chris Coast admitted at one point that he was starting to doubt the team would make the playoffs. I mean, there have to be tons of guys in that clubhouse who, I mean, before now were doubting that the team would make the playoffs. Cause we've talked about how they just looked like a certain amount of lifelessness was in this team, even when they were still in it more considerably. And I, you know, in not wanting to say that anybody gave up, cause I don't really believe that. There has to be, when doubt sets in like that, it's gotta be like toxic. And maybe beating the best pitcher, one of the best pitchers in the league, like Ben Sheets in 2008, like that's going to turn it around. But this Phillies team in 2018, they just never had a win like that, where they came out and like beat the crap out of Kyle Freeland, you know, or somebody that was really considered at the top of their games this year. Yeah. So I don't, I mean, that's certainly something that was missing. I think you would agree.
They needed to put up like an eight spot on like Max Scherzer or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, they let John Lester, you know, boss him around for a start, which was embarrassing, I thought, because I think he sucks. And I would have liked the Phillies to do that. I think it was John Lester.
It was, yeah. When they played the Cubs, absolutely. Yeah, that was.
I mean, they've had opportunities to put a hurting on a bunch of different pitchers this year, and they just never did. So it's frustrating that, you know, they never had something like that. You know, they had like tough wins where, you know, Gabe Kapler said we really went for it in this extra innings win, but that's not the same as like a dominating, confidence building, you know, just slapping pitches around type of win.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I mean, in reviewing what these two teams that obviously went to the World Series did, obviously there's a million little things that go into winning even a single baseball game, but you can really see what the difference is in that, even just like the W's that for the 2018 team are L's, it just moving forward, like what the 2018 Phillies were missing, because they were unable to sort of capture that like momentum, that like lightning that both of these teams had, and just like as on a skill level, they just aren't collectively a good enough baseball team to accomplish what you know, a playoff team needs to accomplish to reach the postseason. So, yeah, and chronicling what these teams did, that absence becomes very clear, because I couldn't. I mean, what's funny is that I don't think that if you could say the 2018 Phillies were good at anything, it's sweeping four game series, which they did three times, which I don't remember any Phillies team doing that as frequently as they did. But yeah, the 2008 Phillies did it when they had to, and I think that's the difference. They winning those four games against the Brewers was big. They went from being three games back to one game back by the end of that series, and then, like I said, they went to Atlanta and swept the Braves, and after that series they were in first place by half a game. So on September 7th, after that Mets series, they were the Mets were still up two games, which, it seems amazing that 2008 team, I mean, I know we all know that they weren't even the best Phillies team from that era, even though they won the World Series, but they were still like battling for first place in the NL East in September and didn't get in first place and stay in first place until September 20th when there were like eight games left in the season. So, but yeah, on September 11th, when they played the Brewers, Carlos Ruiz squeeze bunt won them the game. And I just wanted to mention that because I don't remember him being a prolific bunter by any stretch of the imagination. And the way that play went down, he actually like walked onto the field to go to his at bat and then like turned to the dugout and asked what the sign for a bunt or for a squeeze play was, just because he didn't even know what it was at that point. So, but yeah, Phillies 2008 really caught fire, and one of the contributors during this seven-game win streak in Atlanta was a young man named Jay Happ. That's right, Liz. This is the Jay Happ episode.
Oh, my You've God. Been dreading a whole it. Episode. What did we ever do to deserve this?
So many times Liz has called me screaming, unprovoked, that we should never do a J-Hap episode. And I said, I'm going to do it, Liz. Then you can't stop me.
And obviously J-Hap, have not.
2008, J-Hap only appeared in 8 games for the Phillies anyway. He did 2 in July, did 1 in August. And then September is when he had the most of his appearance. He started 2 games that September on the 17th and the 22nd. He appeared in 3 other games. His season ERA had reached all the way up to 5.71. By the end of the season, he'd gotten it down to 3.69. And his longest appearance was the start against the Braves on September 22nd. He lasted 6 2/3. He struck out 5, only gave up 5 hits and 2 runs. You know, he gave the Phillies what they needed. And I'm sure you're like me. I mean, this season he actually won the Paul Owens Award for like the top pitcher in the Phillies minor league system. I'm sure you're like me that you sort of throw him into that same school of pitchers from this era, the Kyle Kendrick, the Vance Worley, the guys who kind of came up, were effective enough that you thought, yeah, maybe. And then like the second time through the league was like, yeah, I don't think so. And just kind of beat the crap out of them. I always throw Tyler Cloyd in there too. That's not accurate. That's wrong. He was not one of those guys.
Wasn't he on the team though?
2008.
Oh, not in 2008, no, but...
No. Yeah, I just mean, I throw Tyler Cloyd into that school of guys, who, like guys who came up where you're like, oh, who's this guy? Wow, he looks okay. Oh, he is not okay. Okay,
No.
He was never really... I think he had... I looked at his numbers, and he actually had, like, 2 good starts, and that was the Tyler Cloyd era.
That could have been enough for us at the time.
It probably was, yeah. J-Hap, though, who would have thought the pasty 25-year-old little boy with the open-mouth smile would still be in the league 10 years later and an all-star for the first time this year. Did you know, Liz, that in 2016, J-Hap had more Cy Young votes than Masahiro Tanaka?
What?
Yeah, that's a true statement.
Wow.
Yeah, he also had more Cy Young votes than Aaron Sanchez, but I felt like Tanaka was a more impressive statement. So from a book called Great Expectations, A Lost Toronto Blue Jays Season by John Lott, J-Hap is quoted as saying, when you lose a lot more games than you expected, it starts wearing on you and you start noticing things that you normally wouldn't notice. Now, I know that's kind of an innocuous, mundane quote, but I keep finding myself drawn to statements like this. Like, obviously, I zeroed in on that Chris Coast admittance, doubt in the Phillies, because, I mean, that's the kind of season we've had. And I'm very interested in what goes on in a clubhouse in situations other than when the team is doing really well, because most often you're just not clued into that. Even the people who have access to the clubhouse don't really talk about it too much because it's probably not that interesting. I mean, sometimes you get the 2003 Phillies and they all hated each other and there were like fights breaking out. But at the same time, that's not something that comes out in mass until like after the fact. So we have talked about how we don't really know too much about the inner workings of Gabe Kapler's clubhouse. We've had a couple of guys say like, oh yeah, we respect Gabe. We think everything's fine. And back when they were winning, you know, that's all you needed. And now that the team has looked so bad for most of August and entirely of September, you kind of wonder more about, I wonder what is going on there, like what the general morale is. We've heard that it shifted, not necessarily like went bad, but it changed after a bunch of the veterans were acquired around the trade deadline. And then this J-Hap quote just kind of made me think, you know, like when you lose a lot more games, you start thinking about other details of the game and, you know, that mental aspect, when you're thinking too much, you're going to, there's going to be more missteps. You're going to make more mistakes because you're thinking about things that you're supposed to, you know, are supposed to be instinctive or reflexive. So, and I don't think anybody's going to talk about this season and Gabe Kapler without talking about overthinking. So I don't know. I mean, that's, I think one of the, when we talk about 2018 for the Phillies, I think that's one of the epidemics we might wind up talking about is that there was just, you know, they started sliding. They tried to stop sliding. They continued sliding. And because of that, I think that a lot more guys, especially younger guys, are just in their heads too much. And I don't know. I was wondering if you agreed with that.
I definitely agree with that. I always feel like I can tell when Gabe Kapler feels a game slipping away from him because it's like his fingers grow in length and he just wraps them around the neck of the game so many times and so tightly. It's like he's strangling the game, trying to get it to bend to his will when it's not going the way he wants. And so I feel like that is definitely an in, at least for the manager, he can be in his head, I think, at least from my observation. And I think Rhys Hoskins does the same thing. You see him get frustrated at the plate a lot. You know, when he's talking to the umpire, you know, like visibly speaking to him before and after the at bat, you know that he's frustrated. You know, the other guys, you don't quite, I don't know, they're very, some of them are very muted.
When you see what some of these players are capable of when they are playing well, and then you see how long that they can disappear for, which, you know, we talk about consistency and the lack of it for this team a lot. And it's been mentioned so often how that is a symptom of a young team. I think you're absolutely right. I think Rhys Hoskins and Odubel Herrera are two of the guys who suffer the most from being in their own heads when they're going through a frustrating stretch. And I think that's really, yeah, that's been something else that's really hurt the Phillies. Like when their two best hitters can disappear for so long, we know that they're capable of hitting the ball. We know they're capable of even like hitting good pitchers. So clearly it's not what's going on the field. I think it's more what's going on in their heads, and that becomes what's going on the field. Yeah. And you know, with a cerebral guy like Gabe Kapler in the clubhouse, with a mental skills coach hired one or two seasons ago, Jeff Miller, I don't know. You'd think this would be something that you can never predict, I guess, exactly. The human mind is such a rich puzzle of a million pieces, but at the same time, they seem to have the resources available and want to create the kind of environment where dealing with the mental aspect of baseball, which is so much of it, is that there's at least an outlet, you know, or two for guys to go to someone to pull out of these downward spirals. And it just didn't happen this year. So you just, I don't know, it just makes you wonder, because they seem like they set themselves up to deal with things exactly of this nature.
You can never know in baseball. The best laid plans, you know, it's a mystery. It's why people continue to pour so much money and time into figuring out how to strangle the game to their will and make it so they can win more easily. It's what the opener is. You know, they're just trying to bend the game to their will.
Liz, you are talking a lot about strangling people today, and I got to tell you, I love it. yeah, just some terrific imagery of Gabe Kapler's fingers crying.
I've been reading a lot of weird books.
And Gabe Kapler just throttles the game when it's out of his control, and then just realizes he's gone too far and throws the game in his trunk and drives deep into the woods. And he starts digging a hole where he throws the game in and drives away, hoping no one saw him.
Well, and I'll tell you the non-baseball books I've been reading. I finished reading Lost Girls, which is a true crime novel by, I think it's Robert Culker, about unsolved prostitute murders on Long Island. And then I started The Indifferent Stars Above, which is like a harrowing telling of the journey of the Donner Party. So
we are all very much in a healthy mindset to answer your questions, listeners, as we enter the season's final.
I'm game. Fine. I'm okay.
I'm fine, Liz assures listeners, unprovoked.
I'm please don't look at my choice in literature as a call for help. I am totally fine.
Well, that'll about do it for us this time on Continued Success. Don't forget to listen to Hittin' Season with John Stolness, myself, and Liz. John does another episode of Hittin' Season typically during the week. He has on multiple guests. He talks about what the Phillies are up to, and that'll go on long into the off season. And of course, we've got another episode of The Dirty Inning, our bi-weekly chronicle of some of the Phillies' dumbest, most boring, most obscure, forgotten innings that are broken down by myself and Dr. Trevor Strunk. That'll be coming on Monday. And if you can spare it, don't forget to contribute some cash to our Patreon, and you will have access to a whole mess of bonus content, including dirty inning recaps of more recent innings the Phillies have played. John has been doing series previews. We got This Week in Phillies History segments. I mean, It's a whole bunch of stuff over there that's worthy of your time and your money. So if you feel like you can spare it, please hit up our Patreon. We would be honored to have you a part of it. And yeah, keep listening, and we'll talk to you next time on Continued Success.
Hey, everybody. How you doing? Well, that's good. My name is Bill Matz. I am the director of Fun and Games for Broad Street Hockey Radio Podcasts.
And I am Kelly, the deputy managing editor of BroadStreetHockey.com.
I'm Steph Driver, the NHL editorial manager for SB Nation.
And I am Charlie O'Connor, lead Flyers writer for TheAthletic.com.
And together we make up BSH Radio, one of the shows that you get at the SB Nation podcast family. We have a lot coming to you this year, and we want you to listen to our show. It is just an all Flyers, all the time show, so much content. I really hope you listen to it. It is a great piece of the SB Nation podcast family, along with all your other favorite sports.
We all love hockey, specifically the Flyers.
Let's go the Flyers.
The hockey team, the Flyers.